Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weight loss. That's PlushCare.com/weight loss. PlushCare.com/weight loss.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Calling Tau City, turn on your radio. I know we had some words last time, but that was so long ago. I got your message. It was a little harsh, you know. It's still a little hard for me to hear. Please take it slow.
Welcome to Starship Sofa, part of the District of Wonders Network. Everyone has a story in the District of Wonders. Come and find yours.
I'm tuning in to your transmissions. I'm rooting, waiting to be found. And I'm building rockets. I'm pointing them to the moon.
This is the Starship Sofa. Everybody, welcome. Hello and welcome to show 729. I am your host, Tony C. Smith. Hello, everyone. Hope everyone is fine and dandy. I had so many plans today. Outside and just pouring down. We've had two lovely days, the kind of distracting thing, winter's over. There's so many gardening jobs, yes. You know, I wish they'd just enclosed in like a big, you know, like one of those kind of Valley Forge greenhouses in space where like the rain doesn't matter. Man, terrible. Tell you what's coming in today's show. Get off that tone. Tell you what's coming in today's show. We have Stone by Stone by Eric Del Carlo. Then, as a little treat now, just a little treat, I'm in the process of setting up another podcast, a science fiction podcast, a science fiction technology podcast. And I've, you know, kind of put the feelers out there. Brian Alexander is going to be joining me in that. Maybe another guest as well, just to talk about anything to do with like science fiction, that technology now, because it feels like now at this moment, at this precipice, there's so much happening. You know, like Neuralink with, you know, like Elon Musk and everything, like, you know, SpaceX and everything, but AI, even just, you know, most people now just take for granted, you know, like sitting on a train, watching your phone, you know, watching that's all just amazing technology. We all take for granted now, but there's companies at the forefront now pushing the boundaries even more. And, but it does hark back to, you know, the science fiction, that kind of the Philip K. Dick's ideas and theories and everything like that. And, you know, and what I'm going to do at the end of this show is just, at the moment, we're just in the kind of planning stage. So I thought, you know, I just took a little snippet of like, we meet up, you know, once in a while, and we just kind of chat a little bit about how we're going to put the structure of the show together and just chat. So there's a little clip at the end of it. And, you know, each week I'll let you know how close we're getting to launch of the Sofanauts. So I'll give you a little heads up about Eric Del Carlo for the main fiction, which I mentioned is Stone by Stone. Eric Del Carlo's fiction has appeared in Asimov's, Strange Horizons, and other venues. Stone by Stone is set in his recurring Red March universe. Other stories transpiring in this continuum have appeared in Analog and Clark's World. He lives in his native California. This story is original to Starship Sofa. Now, as well, it's also narrated by the one and only Mr. Mark Nelson. Mark Nelson began audiobook narrations in 2006 and now has over 180 titles at LibriVox. And recording as Harry Shaw has more than 100 for Audible. While Mark mainly records sci-fi, fantasy, horror titles, he has also ventured into the classics, including Hugo and Dostoevsky. Didn't say that right, did I not? So, the Starship Sova is very proud to present
Stone by Stone by Eric Del Carlo. It had simply not occurred to him that there would be unbelievers working on the project. This was, after all, to be the palace, that unprecedented edifice, the ambition of 1,000 masterful architects which would one day house the Arch-Hierophant. That office had grown as the palace had grown. By the time, in the relatively near future and after centuries of labor, that the glorious worldlet was ready for occupation, the Arch-Hierophant, whomever held the title at that time, would be a radiant, supremely venerated figure. The final voice of religious authority in the galaxy. Garkin was dismayed, even affronted, that anyone would come to work on the palace's raising who did not also devoutly believe in the benevolent hand of the divine. Yet there he was, assigned to the adjacent constructional section, within Garkin's sight, often within range of hearing. A being of mustard and teal hide, bulky, brawny, seething with stamina and personality. And oh, how he sang! Those ribald ditties, so inappropriate! But there was worse. Garkin had been exposed to this being's casual disdain of faith, his outspoken sacrilege. He had no love for the current Arch-Hierophant, nor for any next holder of the office. The unbeliever was called Lujorn. Garkin tried, with holy effort, not to hate him. Garkin himself came to the task with great solemnity. All his life, since he was old enough to make any kind of contribution to his homeworld, he had been a builder. And all his life, truly all, since earliest childhood, he had wholeheartedly believed. The invisible, unyielding presence of the divine was always there for him, self-evident, pervasive, compassionate, insistent. It wasn't until adolescence that Garkin encountered unbelief. He was stunned, incredulous. Surely this was a joke. How could any being not believe? Yet this apostasy seemingly had no bounds. Soon enough, as adulthood came and his horizons naturally broadened, he found himself among those who scoffed at belief, who thought the divine was a juvenile preoccupation, even those who ridiculed the Arch-Hierophant herself. His upbringing in a pious family hadn't prepared him for this. Yet he adjusted after a fashion. He threw himself into his chosen field, construction, the building of things. He was an eager apprentice, then a flourishing artisan, finally a consummate journeyman. He built homes, factories. He participated in local infrastructure projects. Later, he used his skills on other worlds, for the galaxy was wide open. He made a name for himself. It was always with a specific purpose, however. Since long before his birth, the palace had been under construction. He knew its significance. One day, the august personage of the Arch-Hierophant would reside there. Only the best laborers were called to this work. So he strove and strove. And just when he began to think that opportunity would pass him by, fate had touched him. He had earned his way onto a work crew. He would help to raise the palace. And here he was, amidst the clangor and commotion, the whole vast busyness of the enormous worksite. The palace had started out as an artificial moon, in which were seated the awesome power sources and the sophisticated drives that would breathe perpetual life into the finished project. On top of that core had already been built the foundations, and from there the layers had been set, each atop the next, rising and gaining the intricate strata of the palace. The scope of the project couldn't be overstated. Garkin had never been involved in something so big. But it wasn't, of course, just the size. There was the grandeur, already well evident in the still unfinished product. Only the finest materials had been curated. Slabs of precious stone, wood selected from the rarest forests, or those grown with a lifetime's care in laboratories to produce the richest finishes, the glossiest textures. Alloys which were fairy-spun miracles. Beams and fittings and skeletal braces that were like works of priceless art. There were greater wonders yet being worked into the palace. The staircase of floating mirrors, the parlor of scintillations, the liquid alabaster maze. These special attractions were under the auspices of architectural virtuosos. Such creations were zeniths in the careers of these visionaries. Some of these marvels had been completed. Garkin had seen none of them, much less been called to aid in their assembly. His tasks were of a more basic order. In his constructional section, they planted struts and joists. They made ready for the installation of walls and floors. A good deal of automation assisted the builders naturally, but Garkin was proud to exert himself physically on the project. The palace, which would stand for all time, would have in its bones some infusion of himself, a minute but righteous signature, testament to the strain and struggle he had given this edifice. Meanwhile, one section over, the braying Lujorn was leaving behind an imprint of impiety and coarseness. Where Lujorn was burly, Garkin was trim with an intense, wiry strength. He kept his white furry body groomed, and shorn his facial fur with its red highlights so that it was a modest fuzz. He also wore clothes, which Lujorn did not. To be fair, many species didn't, and races of every description were at work on the palace. But Garkin added this nudity to the list of Lujorn's offenses. The work site was sacred ground. Everyone should demonstrate a little propriety. Even as he thought this, the voice rang out. Lujorn, belting some ghastly limerick. The echoes infested the labyrinth of girders and spars, and Garkin winced. Labor machines slid up and down and back and forth, but no one was nearby to see his discomfort. He concocted a hasty prayer, calling on the divine to enlighten his fellow builder, or at least shut him up for a time. An atmosphere had already been wreathed around the worldlet, but there was no weather to speak of, just a gentle general temperature. Quarters for the builders floated above the uncompleted structures. A sun, as artificial as the moon, orbited. At the close of the workday, Garkin accompanied others up to the floating pods, which were utilitarian but not mean in any way. Sleeping, eating, and recreation facilities awaited the many workers. Garkin didn't readily socialize, but always joined in heartily whenever a group prayer occurred. So many had come to labor on the palace for the same reasons as he, to participate in the aggrandizement of the Arch-Hierophant, who ruled on religious matters, whose word was already accepted by multitudes across the five mites of the galaxy. But how much more authoritative would be those solemn decrees when they were issued from the formidable citadel of this special little world? Garkin was seated and eating when he heard it. The brayer, the apostate. These brash words, he said, loud enough to carry across the busy cafeteria. No single being deserves this palace. We should stop building it, right now. A deep, rich chuckle followed. It was as though this irreverent comment sought Garkin out specifically, as if it crossed the tables occupied with a host of disparate beings, all sizes, all skins, all bodily configurations, and pierced his fuzzy pointed ears expressly. Garkin dropped his utensils. He stood. Rigidly, he strode across the broad room. He didn't know what he would say. Irate impulses crowded his head. What came out in clipped tones when he reached Lujorn's table was, "That was a terrible thing you said." Lujorn's large head rose smoothly. He was bipedal, with the one head, two eyes, one mouth evolutionary design which was quite common throughout the galaxy's star-faring races. He didn't try to be coy with Garkin.
"That, friend," he said, "was a joke."
"It wasn't funny."
"Your opinion."
"If you believe work on the palace should stop, then stop it yourself. Leave. You won't be missed."
This last Garkin said with an edge. He was unaccustomed to confrontation like this. Lujorn sat with Chums. They stirred, but Lujorn quieted them with a look. With a reverberant voice that carried no threat, he said,
"Let me explain how a joke works. It requires an exaggeration, something so outsized as to make the entire remark ridiculous."
In the universal gestural language, he made a movement with his big hand which conveyed sincerity.
"I exaggerated in my call to cease work on the palace because I don't wish it to stop. This is a very prestigious assignment, as you well know."
Garkin's ire still trembled inside him.
"You also said no one being deserves the palace."
"Oh, that I did mean."
"That's profane."
"It's an opinion. Mine this time."
Amusement had crept onto his features. Again, his fellows gathered around him at the table, stirred. Garkin had overstayed. This confrontation might turn physical. Swallowing any further rebuke, he returned to his own table, but had no appetite for his food. He went off to the sleeping pods, but his exchange with Lujorn played again and again in his mind. He thought of clever things he might have said, even threats he could have made, but it was too late for that now. It was a surprise when the next day, after a long shift directing automatons and even using tools with his own hands, Lujorn invited him to sup at his table. Garkin was nonplussed. This didn't seem to be another joke, not unless the exaggeration was the friendly overture itself. Garkin, after a brief hesitation, went to dine with the larger, more muscular being. Only two others from Lujorn's entourage of yesterday sat at the table, and they both stayed silent. Lujorn engaged him in a talk about the project. He added no snide observations, but spoke in straightforward, learned fashion. Plainly, he was an accomplished builder.
"I've put up obelisks, fortresses, bridges," said Lujorn, eating heartily as they talked. "Naturally, nothing compares to this undertaking."
Garkin hesitated again, then said, "I was beginning to think I wouldn't be called to this work."
It was the first personal information he had shared at this strange meal. He found it difficult to square his dinner companion with the obnoxious being who yelled lewd songs out among the beams.
"Well, the future palace will benefit from your contribution. I can tell that much even from one section over."
Lujorn added a chuckle, but again it was friendly.
"Why have you invited me to eat with you?"
Garkin blurted. He winced. He hadn't meant to ask so bluntly. But Lujorn made a hand-spreading gesture which indicated that no offense was taken. He was adept at the universal gestural language, which eased communication among the races gathered under the Galactic Cooperation.
"Because we have different views. That excites me."
The statement seemed rational, even mature, but Garkin still had difficulty with it.
Why did you say that about the Arch-Hierophant, her being undeserving?"
Anger threatened to return to him. Lujorn met the question without flinching, and in a non-inflammatory manner.
"The palace will be far, far too big for one person, in my view."
"Yes, it will be big, obviously, and just as obvious is that the Arch-Hierophant will hardly be alone. There will be attendants, advisors, clerks, an ocean of clerks, maintenance personnel, guards. A legion will inhabit this place when its time comes."
Lujorn had finished his food. He wiped at his mouth.
"And who," he asked quietly, "will they say lives here?"
"The Arch-Hierophant."
"Precisely."
"But it's a monumentally important post. the Arch-Hierophant will speak spiritual truth to the entire galaxy.
Well, the galaxy might hear her, but it won't necessarily listen.
This was another flirtation with blasphemy, Garkin thought, and the trembler of anger in him grew stronger. That's needlessly uncouth, and it isn't her. The current Arch-Hierophant is female, that is true, but her health declines as age increases. She will not be the one to be installed here. That will fall to a successor.
Fine. Then pick a shepherd for this august role, or a water farmer, someone who can dispense wisdom and insight while wading in a brook. That individual, even I might heed on spiritual matters.
A flash of a smile. No mistake, the crude levity had come back. This whole meal had been some kind of trap. Seething, Garkin realized that Lujorn's two friends had slipped away from the table. They faced each other alone. Lujorn's face now broke into an outright grin. With great zest, he said,
"See? Different views. Wonderful."
But it wasn't wonderful. Garkin was prepared to storm away from the table. It only remained to see if he would rudely flip over his food tray as he did so. Before he could make his move, Lujorn leaned forward and spoke once more in his quiet, serious voice.
"My friend, I am always open to the possibility that I am wrong. If you wish to discuss deeper matters, I'll await your convenience."
With that he stood, sketched a rather courtly bow, and withdrew from the table. Garkin could only blink after him. He was absorbed in his work, beneath the cloudless warmth of the artificial sun, when word came of the fatality. Today Garkin felt quite in tune to his labors, both the physical execution of his prescribed tasks and the profound worth underpinning them. He was literally helping to house the Arch-Hierophant. These walls would one day hold that lofty personage. The quarters he laid would sound with the dignified footsteps. It imbued him with a beatific sense of peace and righteousness. Accidents had occurred on jobs he had worked in the past. Even the most safety-conscious projects had their risks. The palace's builders were all highly valued, and precautions were taken, a whole regiment of them, in fact. But error might still slip through, especially considering the tremendous scope of this constructional venture. But there, it had happened. Not in any section adjacent to Garkin's, but near enough that the worker had no doubt eaten and slept in the same cluster of pods overhead. Details were sparse, and Garkin didn't seek them out. A mishap, a fall, that was enough to know. The day naturally turned somber, and when it was done and the crews were lifted to the pods, Garkin was heartened to see that a group prayer was forming in the recreational pod, the largest area available to the workers. Faces were drawn. Movements were appropriately subdued. Garkin prepared himself to pray ardently for the delivery of the builder's soul into the hand of the divine. He was pleased, though out of respect he gave no outward sign, to see how many devout were gathered. He was further startled, nearly to the point of making a surprised squeal, to find Lujorn among the assembled. The big builder stood almost meekly, confusion in his eyes. It had been days since their confrontation in the cafeteria. Garkin, feeling a sense of duty crossed with cautious experimentation, went over to the larger being.
"If prayer is unfamiliar to you, I can guide you."
He braced himself for a crude rebuke. But Lujorn was immediately appreciative.
"Yes, yes, my friend, please. I want to honor Vilasa. I played dice with her, spoke with her, a sweet-natured being."
Garkin was moved, particularly by Lujorn's instant trust in him. He led him into the big, still-gathering circle. After a few more moments, everyone was in place. Lujorn looked sidelong, nervously, but Garkin made a reassuring gesture. The prayer began. It wasn't officiated by anyone. Voices rose in unison. It was a simple invocation, with a repeating chanted motif. This Lujorn picked up readily and matched Garkin as he intoned the words. As always, when he gave himself to prayer, Garkin felt the sublime presence, the cosmic caress. To pray was to commune with the divine, to count oneself present, and to acknowledge the far greater entity who moved the universe with a benign hand. The builder's name was solemnly eulogized. Vilasa. Garkin hadn't thrown dice with her and could not recall ever speaking to her, but she had given her life for the palace. It was a noble sacrifice. When the group prayer ended, people dispersed silently but with a more contented air. Ujorn lingered by Garkin's side and bent his head to murmur, "Friend, can I see you privately?" The workers didn't sleep in a dormitory, but the individual quarters were tiny. Garkin had to stand while Ujorn sat down on his bed. He appeared troubled. Finally, he asked, "What was that about?" Garkin saw that he would have to explain prayer to this person. Ujorn, then, wasn't just disdainful, he was ignorant. But Garkin's newfound benevolence toward him summoned the necessary patience. "Tonight we commended Vilasa's soul to—" But Ujorn cut him off with some force. "No one said anything about her. Not a word. Nothing personal. This was all just ritual." It didn't change Garkin's approach. An education in the fundamentals of prayer was still the answer here. He resumed. But Ujorn made a dismissive gesture. He looked sad now. A part of Garkin wanted to comfort him, but Ujorn's nakedness of all things stopped him. It still felt inappropriate, the teal and mustard body so bare, his genitals, if that was what they were, dangling exposed. Suddenly, Garkin was too aware of the closeness of the room. A strange tingling went over his own flesh, which was properly clothed. "I thought, perhaps," Ujorn said at last, voice heavy, "that your faith had some purpose, some application, that it might try to answer the awful question of that woman's untimely death. But no, it offers rote phrases, dry recitations. I'm sorry, my friend. I wish to be alone now." Garkin backed out into the passageway, taking a last look at Lujorn's nude form before turning smartly and walking away. In the days which followed, Garkin embraced competitiveness. He decided he would best Ujorn at the work of building. Much progress had been made since Garkin had come to the site. Memory of his arrival was still bathed in a holy light as he saw his lifetime ambition being fulfilled. Since then, he had helped to add layer upon layer, raising the collective edifice toward the bland sky above. He obsessively tracked Lujorn's headway in the neighboring section. He noted each strut.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Every eye beam, and he poured all his energy into laboring harder, faster. He drove the automatons around him like an overseer. Lujorn appeared blissfully unaware of any competition between them. He regularly called Garkin over to dine with them and his cronies. Lujorn's apparently innate jollity had returned to him. He was as ribald and jocund as ever, though he left off any outright insulting commentary regarding the Arch-Hierophant when Garkin was at the table. This did not mean, however, that all potentially uncomfortable subjects were eschewed. One evening, after a particularly strenuous day for Garkin, the question of modesty came up for discussion.
"But what does it accomplish?"
This was Lujorn, again approaching a topic with his amused, bewildered air, as if the basics of decency were all foreign to him. Garkin's muscles rippled sorely beneath his white fur. He wanted to finish his food, groom himself, and sleep soundly. But Lujorn's words were like a challenge. "To be modest is to refrain from detracting from the beauty with which the divine has imbued the universe." Garkin spoke almost in a monotone, and everyone had hushed by the time he finished. A variety of eyes, compound, pools of liquid, eyes on glistening stalks, stared at him. A being to Lujorn's right, reptilian flesh and bony backspikes, made a gesture of confusion.
"I absolutely don't understand that."
Lujorn spoke.
"I think our friend means that everything is already lovely, and if we show off, in behavior, in dress, then we're just calling unnecessary attention to ourselves and spoiling the prevailing splendor. Yes?"
He was waiting on Garkin.
"That's it," he said,
bracing himself for whatever apostasy might follow.
"I agree with the former," said Lujorn. "It's a splendid universe, even the dismal parts. But I see no reason to be reluctant in adding to that beauty. Celebrate it, emulate it, laugh when you can, wear fancy dress."
"Well," Garkin muttered, "some of us don't dress at all." Lujorn heard and burst with a loud chuckle.
"And some of us don't laugh. I've never seen you do it, friend."
"Not every species laughs."
"Quite true, but the universal gestural language provides ample equivalence."
Garkin wanted to snap back at him. He wanted to say something devastating, a remark which would undercut Lujorn's entire structure of gaiety and aggressive confidence. But he was so very tired.
"And as for immodest displays," Lujorn went on, "this palace is the most ostentatious spectacle imaginable. You can't deny it. That is its purpose. You've said as much."
Again the table went quiet, and once more it was Garkin and Lujorn gazing fraughtly at each other. Still, no useful rejoinders occurred to Garkin. His mind was fogged with fatigue. He could only think,
"We are engaged in a contest you know nothing about, and I will defeat you in it."
He would leave it there. He'd finish eating. He was about to mumble a farewell when Lujorn, in an almost wistful tone, said,
"Hardly matters, I suppose. This palace will be rubble one day, which should be very modest indeed."
Garkin pressed even harder, outshining his fellow workers in his section, and often inspiring them, too, to labor with added diligence. Their part of the interconnected structure now rose noticeably higher than Lujorn's section. He devoted thought, when he had time to think, to counter-arguments he could make against Lujorn's blasphemies. It would be easier if the bigger builder weren't so damned affable. But what gnawed the borders of his mind was Lujorn's comment about the palace one day being rubble. Not possible. This worldlet wasn't just a work of incomparable aesthetic splendor. It was built to be a stronghold, invincible, impregnable. The Arch-Hierophant, once installed, would be safe from harm forever. So, what had Lujorn meant? Garkin had to know. Summoning his courage, because Lujorn intimidated him despite his outward friendliness, he accosted the other where the shuttles collected the builders to take up to the floating pods. In a tight, low voice, he said,
"The palace in ruin. How do you know?"
Again, Lujorn wasn't coy. He didn't pretend not to know what Garkin was speaking of. Giving him a measured look, he said,
I can show you, friend. Join me after the others are asleep.
It left Garkin in a state of anxiety. After supper, he waited, fidgeting, in his own cramped quarters. Finally, when the hour felt right, he rose to go to Lujorn. But he found the large builder outside his door. Lujorn made a gesture for silence, then led Garkin furtively down a corridor which branched away from all the other main passageways. They came to some kind of storage room. Garkin saw, with a little alarm, that the lock had been forced. Lujorn took him within, shut the door, and at last spoke.
"You have your religious rituals. Well, this is one belonging to my people. The individual rights of species tend to get subsumed by the greater culture of the galactic cooperation. Once a race reaches star-faring maturity, the cooperation, as you know, takes them in hand and introduces them to the vastness of the galaxy civilization. In the process, certain idiosyncrasies are lost. That's to be expected. But this is a little ceremony my kind retains. I am willing to show it to you."
Once again, Garkin was in a close space with Lujorn, the man who was such a thorn in his side, and once more his level of discomfort rose dramatically. That bare body. Supplies were stacked against the walls, leaving space enough to sit on the floor facing one another. Lujorn had brought a small bag along. Now he took from it an irregular cube. Its sides looked partly melted, and set it between them.
"This," Lujorn said, "will be an altering experience. You may find it disorienting, but it can do you no harm. Should we proceed?"
"Yes." Despite all his discomfitures, Garkin believed that the answer he sought was here. Lujorn touched an asymmetric face of the cube. Light radiated from it slowly, if light could be said to move slowly, which seemed impossible. Yet this soft golden radiance somehow bled languidly from the object. It didn't hurt to look at it. Lujorn was gazing into it with a quietly blissful expression. The light swelled without growing brighter. It streamed without picking up speed. Again, impossibilities. Garkin had avoided narcotics all his life. For the same reason, he'd chosen a modest demeanor. The divine reality required no tarting up with drugs. It was perfectly exalted as it stood. Perhaps Lujorn was subjecting him to a hallucinogenic. Whatever it was, he was determined to withstand it. He stared fully into the gold light, which heaved and mounted now, which climbed onto him. He gave himself over. The radiance was within him. He was suffused. There was no pain, only a new growing awareness, an awareness of the palace. He felt it first as a vague, vast entity. The size, the weight, these came through to him as obscure but staggering data. The information sharpened, and he suddenly knew to microscopic particulars the scope of the palace. He saw it. He realized with a joyous jolt in its completed form. Rooftops crowned the manifold structures. Courtyards lay open to the sky, which was now impregnated with pleasant weather patterns. Soft rain fell occasionally. The wind blew gently, like a caress. And how the worldlet abounded with life! That whole horde of promised attendants and helpers and guardians, all there to aid the master of the house. Garkin plunged down through the soaring towers, somehow able to manipulate his own movements, as if he were something magical. He plummeted among the swarming buildings. His own handiwork was in there. He had contributed to this finished masterwork, helping build it up stone by stone. Down and down he went, through the layers, passing as though through mist, and went into the heart, into the puissant, self-renewing engines which would never die, which would power the palace for all time. He swam amongst these fabled power sources, then shot upward, through the multitude of people and chambers. There was no rubble to be seen. The palace abided. But the Arch-Hierophant, who would that be? If Garkin were seeing the future here,
and some quivering part of him wholeheartedly believed that that was what was happening, then he could glimpse some future holder of the great office. He pivoted in midair. He cast his fantastically powerful senses over the artificial moon. There. Yes, a presence emitting such holiness. It could only be. He raced there to a great room with an onyx floor that spread toward infinity in every direction. It was called the Spiritual Wellspring Chamber, he suddenly knew. And there, yes, yes, was the figure, in dignified but not haughty raiment, skin a blue-green, an air of profound benevolence about him. Him, a male. The old Arch-Hierophant, the current Arch-Hierophant, long dead then. To be expected. Garkin gazed rapturously on this personage. What a wonder to behold! The voice of the divine, the final say in matters of momentous spirituality. The Arch-Hierophant wasn't alone. Well, he wouldn't be. Supplicants would come endlessly to the palace. That was, in part, why it was constructed. The blue-green master spoke to a visiting soft being in black. Another in green appeared. This was a long-time advisor. Some great concern was being discussed, but the debate was many-sided. Potent forces were influencing. The stakes were incredibly high. A current of fear took Garkin as he sensed the extent, if not the substance, of the contentious affair. The Arch-Hierophant's decision would be absolutely critical here. All this was belied by the genteel manner of the being who occupied the office, who took such weight of decree upon himself. A shrieking seemed to rise in Garkin's ears. No one saw him. No one suspected his presence. He was a phantom. But now everything was screaming around him, and the wellspring chamber vanished. The decision, whatever it was, had been made. Blankness followed. Garkin was moving now in some other current. Time. Forward. Ahead again. To... There it was. The spinning wreckage. The bleeding debris. The palace, but not the palace. The palace, shattered. Obliterated. Gone. Only junk in the black now. Was this piece of twisted waste some remnant of the staircase of floating mirrors? But it didn't end here. Garkin felt this as a dark, stony certainty. The devastation only spread from this debris field, ranging across the stars to touch every part of the galaxy. A decision made, then destruction. And that destruction was widespread, catastrophic, galactic. This vision was no less honest and believable than the one which had preceded it, of the Arch-Hierophant in his miraculous chamber with its infinite floor. If he held faith in one vision, he must also in this other. He must. Golden light flowed in, permeated him, saturated him. Then it withdrew, and he was in a storage room, sitting on a floor opposite Lujorn, who looked across solemnly at him. "That is the ruin I have seen," said Lujorn. "Drug?" Garkin's mouth felt thick. "No, not hallucination." He described the drifting wreckage. "You saw this, too?" "Yes." Garkin didn't want to say so, but he couldn't help but admit it. Obliquely, he asked if Lujorn had sensed any sort of further devastation, the galaxy-wide destruction— but he seemed to know nothing of this, and Garkin didn't ask again. Lujorn, who appeared grave but clear-headed, put the strange cube back into his bag. "It's not so terrible a thing, actually. I have long since come to realize that everything I have built, from the meanest hovel to the loftiest monument, will one day inevitably crumble. Might take millennia, or it could happen tomorrow. Entropy always wins. And that is as it should be." He spoke this in the tones Garkin used when pronouncing on religious matters. These, then, were Lujorn's true beliefs. Garkin was still stunned, devastated. The disorientation remained. He shivered as he said, "I saw more. I saw—"
and he narrated his encounter with the future Archhierophant and the terrible decision with its awful repercussions which awaited that illustrious person. Lujorn listened intently.
"I saw nothing of that."
"Does that mean the vision is false?"
Hope reached for Garkin, a desperate grasp.
"Not a vision, my friend. To be honest, I wasn't even certain the light of Farsight would work on you. Its properties exist somewhat outside the continuum. If you were one of my kind, I would say only that what you saw has already happened in a sense. Surrender yourself to it."
Lujorn tried to help him stand, but Garkin wouldn't budge. He sat on the floor as the other left with his sackful of evil miracle. And the shivering grew worse, and Garkin's mind darkened. His job performance dropped off dramatically. He became clumsy, lackadaisical, highly irritable. No longer did he try to surpass the progress of the adjacent constructional section in which Lujorn labored. Garkin's faith had been wounded. When he thought of the Archhierophant now, the present or future ones, he saw the liability of that office, its potential for catastrophe. Momentous decisions would be made. Eventually, a wrong choice would occur. The certainty of this was etched in Garkin's bones. Lujorn's strange, discerning light had carved it there. Finally, he saw no other way forward for himself. Lujorn had done this to him. Lujorn must pay. Garkin was incredibly clever about it. He understood how the automatons festooning the site operated. As a lifelong builder, he had worked with such machines often. He found a way to remotely reprogram a heavy mobile device in Lujorn's section. He neatly covered every minute step of his interference. The next day, the moving tool seemed to go out of control, and it cut through the burly worker with the mustard and teal hide and killed him instantly. It was only at the memorial, held in the recreation pod, that Garkin learned Lujorn had a mate and children back on his home world. But he didn't let this trouble him. He offered up a silent prayer for the deliverance of Lujorn's soul into the hands of the divine.
And there you go. Big Eric, thank you so much. Giving an original to Starship Sofa. Thank you indeed. Mr. Nelson, always a pleasure, sir. Never a chore. Thank you, Mark. So like I mentioned, I'm just going to play the little snippet of what myself and Brian Alexander got up to. And I've got a new Romancer poster coming.
Oh, very good. Very good.
I asked, you know, Brian, I asked ChatGTP, I says, what's the most influential book where technology, I cannot remember the words, it's actually on chat. What's the most, you know, the best book, science fiction, where technology has kind of come to fruition today? I says, I only want one. What's your best book? And straight away just said, William Gibson's Neuromancer.
Interesting.
You know what I mean? So, I went straight to my little Audible account, got that, and I've been listening to that. And it's, I'm sure you know, Brian, it was 1984 when that, you know, and it has not aged, it's perfect. Do you know what I mean? It's like still hitting, like it's, you know what I mean? Still there. And I'm thinking, 1984.
Yeah, it's a fantastic book. I used to teach it in classes. And it's just, you know, there is one thing that will date it, which is that, people ask Gibson, like, what do you feel bad that you didn't get? And he said, mobile phones. Because there aren't any.
Yes.
But there is a fantastic scene with payphones, which I, if you haven't come across it, I don't want to spoil it.
Right. I don't think I have. I think I've got about 4 hours left on my, you know what, on the audio. So what I've been doing, though, which is a really, this wasn't available when I first started using Audible, you know what I mean, is even just jumping to, like, the app, ChatGTP app, and saying, you know, it'll, it he throws, like, you know, it's coming sometimes so fast for you, you know, like the characters and that, and you're thinking, wait a minute, who's this? And then I'll just say to ChatGTP, you know, like, who is, you know, I forget his first name, Flatliner.
Yeah.
You know who's, yeah. And it just gives you this lovely little paragraph, bang, there, all right, carry on. Do you know what I mean? Carry on. And it's just, I've been like, it's almost like an assistant for us listening. Do you know what I mean? Where Google search just wouldn't probably do that as good. You know, it's
So this is the kind of thing you'd want Audible maybe to to have alongside. You know.
Well, yes, it'd be kind of nice to have it alongside, but you know what I mean? It's like, see, it's two different apps, and I just kind of pause and then jump to ChatGTP. I was talking to a friend yesterday, I think, and because I seen the price of Copilot Professional a month, and that was, he got like an email, you know, like if you want to kind of buy it, and I'm sure like a month it was over £100, you know, maybe like 150. There you go. Do you think, you know what I mean? Like you said, we are in the process of working out the structure, you know, how we're going to kind of come and do it, and how, you know, Brian, obviously American, you know, we've got to get the times all right as well to hook up each week, but we're going to plan once a week and maybe come out with somebody else as well as another guest now and again, and bring in guests who have, you know, and maybe, you know, like I say, at this moment, AI is just right at the forefront, and we're all in like this little worried state about it. You know, this kind of confusion: will it take jobs? Will it do this? Will it do that? So it'd be nice to get, you know, other people's perspectives on it as well. So there you go. So as well, now don't forget, if you want to support this show and you don't want to listen to adverts, just come over to Patreon. Honestly, that's where you get the very like special feed of Starship Sofa that has no adverts in it, and you get it a day early as well on a Tuesday. So if you want to support the show, that would be fantastic. There's, like you say, there's a link there to pop over on the front of the page and grab yourself ad free. Until next week, just like to say, good night from me.
Thank you for listening. Time soon, can you reach me? Is my signal getting through? Turn on your radio, I wanna talk to you. This signal's going light speed. By the time I get my say, I might already be on to you and on my way. But you're so far from here, and at best I'm moving slow. So I'm waiting on your call at home with nowhere to go. Can you reach me? Is my signal getting through? Turn on your radio, I wanna talk to you. I wanna talk to you. Myself on a radio wave, I might get to you someday. If books were rocket ships, I'd need only the will to fly. I'm still building word by word, and I'll get out there by and by. I'll get out there by and by. I'll get out there. I'll get out there by and by. I'll get out there by and by. I'll get out there. Get out of there, bye-bye.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.